Welcome to the 2018 Bay Area Book Festival. This is Sherilyn Parsons, founder and director of the festival. Enjoy the conversation.
Let me welcome you to the fourth annual Bay Area Book Festival. Principally the brainchild of Sherilyn Parsons, an indefatigable and talented woman who I have had the privilege to work with as she was an aide-de-camp for the first 10 years that I was principal architect of the Los Angeles Times Festival of Books, of which this festival in some way is an outgrowth of that. And Sherilyn moved to Berkeley about 5 years ago, and to her surprise, in so literate a community, there wasn't anything like what you now have. And so I wanted to express thanks to her and to all of the sponsors of the festival. It isn't an easy thing to put together, either from a logistical or fiscal point of view. And I want to especially acknowledge the sponsors for this session, Reed Schmidt in particular, as an individual who has contributed generously, as well as to the Federated Indians of Grayton Rancheria and the tribal chairman, Greg Saras, who happens to be an author of Heyday Books, but that's pure happenstance. If you haven't already silenced your cell phone or pager, please take a moment to do so now. This session is being recorded, and we will have you will have an opportunity to ask questions. We're going to allot about a half an hour or so for those questions, and there'll be, as I understand it, two people bearing microphones like this. Hold your questions till a microphone is placed in your hand. Hold it reasonably close to your lips, because otherwise, if you ask a question without such an aid, it will not be recorded. And moreover, nobody else will really hear you very well. And at closing, when thanking the speakers, just remember that afterward you will find our speakers' books in the area right outside the theater as you exit, as you walk down the stairs to your immediate left. There'll be a table and there'll be author signings if you want to purchase a copy and get it signed. So without further ado, let me introduce briefly the four gentlemen before you. To beginning in alphabetical order, we have on my far left Edward Ayres, who's the author of the Bancroft Prize-winning book, In the Presence of Mine Enemies. He's been a finalist for such prizes as both the Pulitzer and the National Book Award. And he's president emeritus at the University of Virginia. And I'm delighted to welcome him here today, and to also announce that he won just the other night the very prestigious Lincoln Prize for his most recent book, The Thin Light of Freedom, The Civil War and Emancipation in the Heart of America, published by W.W. Norton. Peter Cousins is the author or editor of more than a dozen acclaimed books about the American Civil War, as well as the campaigns waged against indigenous peoples in the United, what came to be the United States. He's a retired foreign service officer, and his most recent book, published by Alfred A. Knopf, is called The Earth is Weeping, and it tells the epic story of the Indian Wars for the American West. And please welcome him. Joel Richard Paul teaches constitutional law and international law at the University of California Hastings Law School, and his most recent book is the very timely biography of John Marshall, the first Chief Justice of the United States Supreme Court, and called Without Precedent. It is published by Riverhead Books, and it turns out that questions having to do with the rule of law become every day more pertinent. Please welcome him. And T.J. Stiles, a two-time winner of the Pulitzer Prize and an acclaimed biographer of such characters as Custer, Cornelius Vanderbilt, and Jesse James, now for some years, a resident and citizen of Berkeley. So welcome all. It's interesting. We're going to have a conversation about both the making, the writing of history, why it matters, who it's written for, and perhaps some issues having to do with the craft and publishing itself. It has been said famously by Faulkner that history. What is the phrase? It's gone out of my mind.
The past is never past.
Or as Karl Marx put it in another register, history is a nightmare that weighs on the brain of the living. But on the other hand, one of the conceits of America is that in its settlers and its colonists' desire to rid themselves of Europe's suffocations, one of the conceits was that it could rid itself of the weight of history and invent a republic free to invent itself. And so it did, and here we are in California, a state which the late Susan Sontag once called America's America, which was the place where social amnesia and a desire to kick history to the curb was perhaps most obvious in its residents' insistence on their untrammeled right to reinvent themselves. One of the questions that I wanted to ask all of you, and you can answer it individually, is with so many books about the subjects that you've most recently dwelled on. You would think, to begin with, Mr. Ayres, you would think that everything that needs to be said about the Civil War and emancipation had been said. I mean, probably other than the libraries devoted to Winston Churchill and Napoleon, there have been more books about Lincoln and the Civil War than perhaps any other subject in history. And yet, it does appear, even from a cursory walk into the embarrassment of riches that any good remaining bookstore still has on offer, that this is a subject of endless fascination and that we're actually living in a period of, I would think, a certain golden age of history writing, where once familiar stories or commonplaces are now being re-examined by a whole generation of writers and historians, turning us, upending presumptions, providing nuance, and giving us a new purchase on familiar stories. What, A, is this the case? B, what prompted your own interest in this story? And what did you discover in the writing of it that came as a surprise to you?
Well, I'm outraged that you think one book a week since the Civil War is enough. And that's literally the truth. On average, there's been over 50,000 books written about the Civil War. And I'm pretty sure that's more than Winston Churchill, whoever else you said, that it's the most. And I often quote my mother, who was a fifth grade teacher for 30 years, and I told her I was going to go to graduate school in history. And she said, well, what for, honey? We already know what happened. And which is a pretty good line, and what most people think, and especially about the Civil War. And I'll have to admit, I couldn't have cared less about the Civil War for all of my childhood. You may detect a Southern accent here. I'm actually a hillbilly accent. This is Appalachia. I went to Andrew Johnson Elementary School, which very marginal sort of identity in that regard. But I came into the Civil War because what I'm committed to is writing history that includes everybody. And I'm a historian of the American South in particular, so I've set out to write the story of African-American people and white people and women and men and deserters as well as generals. And so after I'd written a couple of other books, I thought, if I'm going to live in the 19th century, I guess I better tackle the big subject that seems to be sitting in the middle of all this Civil War and emancipation thing, even though, I'll be honest, the topic is identified by many of the cool people I know as somewhat kitschy, as somewhat hackneyed, as being something, I don't know how else you can have an event in which so many people die that people who are interested in it are called buffs, So it's trivialized. And so I went into it with some trepidation, not because I was entranced by it, but because it's the defining event of American history. It's the destruction of the largest, most powerful system of slavery in the modern world. Is what it is. If you turn it around and don't think about it as in the ways that we've learned it, which is like the gray team versus the blue team, but you think about world history pivoted around. Now, living in Virginia, where these things are underfoot and all around, it's even more trivialized because we're so familiar with it that it seems to have lost the gravity, the weight that it deserves. So I took about as long a route to write this book as possible, beginning 3 weeks after the World Wide Web was created. We created an archive that includes every piece of information about every person who lived in a northern county and a southern county from John Brown's raid to the end of Reconstruction. This is before PDF files existed, if people can imagine such a thing. And it took us 14 years to build that. It gives you some idea of how much information there is about this Civil War. And then I set about writing two books about it, one that goes from John Brown's raid to the day before Gettysburg, and this one which goes from Gettysburg through the end of the passage of the 15th Amendment. And the idea was, we don't know anything that the people who were living through it don't know. We are going to, the main impediment to understanding the Civil War is thinking we understand the Civil War, is knowing how it turned out. We have to forget that. Because most of our writing about the Civil War is going back and reading in how it was became such a freaking awesome nation by destroying slavery, instead of how in the world that a war that no one wanted descended on the nation, and thank goodness, under the leadership of Abraham Lincoln and the United States Army, this system of slavery came to an end. So that's kind of, I backed into it from multiple directions. And the main thing I discovered is that there's dark matter in the history of the Civil War that we've not taken into account. That the losers shape the story as much as the winners. And the primary losers, I discover, were the 48% of white men who wouldn't vote for Abraham Lincoln in 1864 in the North. So one thing I say is wherever I go, I insult the people who are kind enough to invite me. So when I'm invited to speak to fellow white Southerners, it's all slavery, get over it. But when I talk to people with amnesia, I say, let's don't be so self-righteous about this. When you had nearly half of white Northern people wouldn't support Abraham Lincoln after the Gettysburg Address, after Gettysburg, after the fall of Atlanta, what does that tell you about the country's endorsement of emancipation and the Reconstruction that followed? So the big surprise for me is how much not only the enslaved people who had no power but still shaped the history, how much the Confederacy put everything at risk and lost it all in what was called the colossal suicide of world history, and how the Democrats, who are virtually invisible in our story, played such a critical role in driving it to the radical conclusion of the 14th and 15th Amendment. So that's several different angles that what the lesson from this is, you don't have to have any idea what you're doing to write a book.
And it seems you avoided the category error of writing history backwards, which is to say, as you rightly put it, you know the outcome, and everything seems preordained in some curious way from our vantage point now, but one must remind oneself in the writing of history that the people living through it at the time did not know how things would turn out.
Peter, who's a distinguished military historian, but we know that about military history, but somehow we've forgotten it about political history and about sort of the larger national racial history. So the trick was, and it's seen as faintly subversive, because if you're not cheering for the good guys at every step of the way, do you have suspect motives that you're not just sort of kind of nudging the story toward the outcome we all want? And no, my general belief is that we're lucky that the war ended the way that it did and with slavery destroyed, because that wasn't in the cards at the beginning.
Do you mind if I say something?
No, jump. We don't have to go in alphabetical order.
Oh, great.
You can address these questions.
I mean, probably most directly from anyone else in the panel, my work fits in with Ed's. And, you know, some of the things he said so well, we should just let him talk maybe, is...
Thanks very much, TJ. And then furthermore...
You can tell, by the way, he founded one of the best podcasts. You can tell that he's got experience. He spoke to two things. One relates to content and trying to ask new and important and interesting questions. And the other is the writing, which is one thing we're talking about. And focusing on, without losing, in fact, to amplify the understanding of the bigger picture, looking at individual human beings and their stories, and which is something that his books do so well, is putting human beings into the story and looking at their lives and their choices. I picked in my most recent book to write about Custer because I was interested primarily in the Little Bighorn, the way he died, but why he was famous and Notorious going into that battle, and it comes so directly out of all the things that he was just talking about, which is Custer had been a Civil War hero on the Union side, and he actually, you know, surprisingly, to a surprising extent, as I researched the book, he earned that reputation and his audience in the North who loved him. But he was also a Democrat. And he is one of those millions of people who helped to stop Reconstruction in the North. And in fact, the reason he went from the Civil War and he began to support Andrew Johnson and he threw himself into politics. And at the end of his life, he nearly missed the Little Bighorn because he'd been siding openly with the Democratic opposition to Ulysses S. Grant, who was president and who had presided over the enforcement of Reconstruction, the Ku Klux Klan Acts, et cetera, all of which Custer hated. And the interesting thing is, for me, is that being a biographer, but being trained as a historian and thinking myself as a historian, there's another Karl Marx quote that comes up, which is, he said, it's true that men make their own history, but they don't make it exactly as they please. They don't make it under circumstances chosen by themselves. By the way, one of the reasons I picked Custer is because the women are making history too, and they're very present in the story. But, you know, individual human beings, of course, don't make all the big decisions. The kind of heroic theory of history is long since by the wayside. And yet individuals play key roles, and they illuminate what goes on in history. And in Custer's case, he, you know, had as his household manager a black woman who was self-emancipated and who used her position to build some authority and security for herself, which put her in some conflict with Custer's wife, whose only authority as a woman in the 19th century was to control the household. And yet there were also two women in a very male environment, and they both go west, and then all of a sudden there's a third racial dimension added to the picture. And so by following these life stories, it's not that Custer made all the decisions and shaped the history, but it was in my own way to plug into all the things that Ed was just talking about. And so finding the interesting people and looking at their stories in new ways, but also understanding, you know, trying to bring to people a new understanding of these very familiar events, I think is key to what we do.
I could amplify one again. We used Ed as the benchmark here. Yeah. If I could amplify one of the comments he made about, you know, winners writing history, the victors, the ones who shape history. In the case of the Indian Wars of the American West, at least since 1970, in a period of time when all of us have done our reading of the American West, the extent we have, it really has been the losers who have shaped our understanding of the history of the period. That is to say that the Indian perspective, or what has been perceived to have been the Indian perspective, has been paramount in the telling of the history of the West in popular nonfiction and fiction, and particularly in cinema. And, you know, I would argue that there was no other period in our history that was as subject to mythologizing or to pendulum swings as our understanding of the Indian Wars in the American West. It had, our understanding of it has much to do with the sense of national guilt or lack thereof as what truly transpired. And, you know, for the first 80 years or so after the Indian Wars, the Indians were generally vilified as impediments to the white settlement of the West, something to be brushed aside, perhaps with no greater concern than the buffalo. And then you had, you know, a grand shift in the late 1960s, early 70s, with the American Indian Movement and this growing sense of national guilt for the wrongs we had perpetrated on the Indians, climaxing with Dee Brown's Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee, an Indian history of the American West. And the pendulum went to the opposite extreme, where the Indians could do no wrong and whites could do no good. And what I wanted to do, attempted to do, was to tell a balanced story, to try to tell the story right down the middle, again, by using a technique that Ed used to the greatest extent possible, let participants on both sides of the story tell their story, and to the greatest extent possible, allow readers to draw their own conclusions from the stories of the individuals who shaped the history. And to try, and this is something that I think is important in writing good history, is to try to keep myself in the background and again, let the story unfold through the voices of participants. And doing that, several things became apparent to me and were somewhat shocking to me. And if I can allow myself another aside, I always think that it's a good idea to write about something, as an historian, to write about something about which you are not an expert and perhaps know very little. Because you can bring to the subject a freshness, a sense of discovery that someone who has, you know, spent all their time from grad school on becoming expert on perhaps can't. And you take less for granted on the reader's part. And it makes you maybe a little more flexible and a little and more receptive to the way the story develops. And some of the things that surprised me in telling the story of the Indian Wars in the American West was first and foremost that, and this is a very much a charged question answer point of view, that I firmly believe the government never intended to commit genocide, at least not physical genocide, with respect to the Indians of the American West. Certainly, to use today's terminology, cultural genocide was taken for granted. Even by the most ardent self-styled advocates of Indian rights, it was taken for granted that the Indian would have to cease to be an Indian in order to survive. The saying kind of was, kill the Indian but save the man. And so that's something that I try to stress in the book, that, you know, for all the missteps, all the broken treaties, all the corrupt administration of Indian policy, it really was not the government's intention to physically exterminate the Indians, but rather to turn them into white men, into white, you know, farmers and make them individuals rather than members of a communal tribe. And we can argue from today's perspective whether that was misguided or not, but I would contend that from the perspective of the period, and when you look at what the British were doing in their colonies or in other colonial powers were doing to native peoples, I think it was intent, at least, was fairly enlightened. Another thing that surprised me, too, is that with very few exceptions within the Army High Command in the West, there was a great deal of sympathy toward the Indian plight and an understanding, appreciation for the fact that indeed, and this is something that I've reflected on, that I maybe should have emphasized more in the book, that the Indians in the West never initiated, at least in a larger sense, any of the major conflicts in the West. And were really quite, showed a remarkable amount of forbearance toward white encroachments. And the Army High Command generally appreciated that and went to war reluctantly. And a third thing, not to take too much time on this, but a third thing that emerged that has been kind of lost in current understanding of what transpired was the fact that there was no sense of Indianness. I'm not sure if that's really a word, but I used it. No sense of Indianness among the Indians of the West. Each tribe thought itself unique, the chosen people of the Creator. And all through the period of the Indian Wars with the whites, tribes were fighting one another. Intertribal warfare was so ingrained in the thinking and in the culture of the Indians in the West that they could not overcome it and create any kind of a pan-Indian resistance to white encroachments. Which actually, and one last comment, I'm working on a book right now on Chief Tecumseh and his brother, the Shawnee Prophet, kind of a prequel. It's looking at the wars of what's called the Old Northwest, today's Midwest. And there was, east of Mississippi, there was a much greater tendency among the Indians to unite and to see a common interest than there was west of Mississippi. And that's something I just kind of currently discovered. But I guess my overarching point is that I took on this subject because I thought it was it was more, it was held hostage to a greater extent to contemporary political assumptions, political correctness, whatever you want to call it, than arguably any other period in American history, and I wanted to try to bring balance to the story.
Well, what interests me about history is the way in which history is shaped by accidents. And my actual involvement in popular history, in part, was an accident. I was writing, I teach international law subjects and international economic law at UC Hastings Law School. And I was researching a book about international law, and I was trying to make it interesting for a popular audience. And I discovered a guy named Silas Dean, who is a shopkeeper in Connecticut, who never left Connecticut in his life and couldn't speak a word of English and didn't know anything about international diplomacy. And so in 1775, when Ben Franklin was looking for somebody he could send to France to persuade Louis XVI to arm the Americans against the British, he chose this guy because Franklin said, "He's so improbable, the British will never suspect him." And I loved that. And I started writing about him and discovered how he succeeded in getting all of the arms and the ammunition and the uniforms for an army of 30,000 men snuck out of France through the British lines, delivered to the Americans in time for the critical Battle of Saratoga with the help of two other men, a French playwright, some of you may know, Beaumarchais, who wrote The Marriage of Figaro and The Barber of Seville. And another man who is the French ambassador to London, who's a very famous war hero, the Chevalier d'Eon, who's a great military officer and a great diplomat, and also a spy working for Louis XV. But what made him interesting was, it turns out, he was a woman who spent the first 40 years of her life pretending to be a man until she meets Beaumarchais and falls in love and decides to come out as a woman. And it's her decision to come out as a woman that provided the catalyst that persuaded Louis XVI to arm the Americans against the British and win the American Revolution. And it's all true. How could you not love that story? So I found myself writing popular history. And I've looked for those kinds of accidents in history. And John Marshall's a guy who most of us may know. He wrote the famous decision, Marbury versus Madison, that established the principles of judicial review. I taught that case for 30 years as a law professor. And that case, in some ways, kind of eclipsed all the other things that Marshall had done as a statesman, a politician, a political leader, and as a diplomat. You may not know, but he was sent to France to persuade the French to stop interfering in American shipping. That became known as the XYZ Affair. He also served as our Secretary of State at a time when we were threatened with war by the British, the French, the Spanish, and the Barbary pirates, and somehow navigated his way through that, while at the same time supervising the construction of Washington, D.C. So I loved the fact that there was this hidden side to his personality and his accomplishments and achievements. He was really probably the indispensable man in the founding generation, and yet we don't really recognize him as such. He was at Valley Forge with George Washington and Alexander Hamilton and the great Prussian general Baron von Steuben, who, by the way, was neither a baron nor a Prussian general, but that's another story. And he sort of somehow impressed these men and became a leader, although he had grown up, unlike all of the other great men in Virginia. Marshall was born poor. He lived in a two-room log cabin, 400 square feet, that he shared with his 14 brothers and sisters. That's that for a close family relationship. And he sort of scratched out his living that way, and somehow without a formal education, without any of the privileges or advantages that Washington and Jefferson and Madison and Monroe and Lee all had, he achieved this enormous accomplishments in his life. And so I was really interested, and what motivates me in history, what really attracts me to history, is the notion of people inventing themselves. And what I learned about Marshall was that the experience he had of self-invention was what informed his talent for inventing the law and legal principles that are still governing us today?
We hear a lot of talk in recent months and last couple of years about fake news. We've heard a lot down the decades and even the centuries about fake history. I mean, from Herodotus to the present. We've learned, if we've learned anything, as readers, not to check our critical faculties at the title page. And certainly the ways in which historians, varying in talent and perspicacity, have in general, you're free, obviously, to disagree with this characterization or generalization, but in general seem to have privileged the written text over oral testimonies. And as any criminal defense attorney can attest, eyewitnesses are often the worst witnesses. So the question, a natural question, an obvious question, in the sifting of evidence to and in the effort to arrange the bits and pieces of the research that you've carried out, and to give each of those factors their salient and proportionate due, how the hell do you go about this process and arrive at anything that might not either be a reflection of a self-serving and unexamined presumption which favors this or that piece of evidence, and or, by contrast, gets near to something that an allegedly less educated or familiar reader might accept or be convinced by as an essential truth?
If I could answer that real quickly, I think I find that that to be a particular advantage of writing about a topic that you, A, are fascinated by, but B, don't necessarily know a great deal about or have strong preconceived notions about, that you don't pick a topic because you want to make a point about it, and you've already decided the outcome and the importance of a particular topic you've chosen, then you are more likely to become slave to sources that reinforce that point of view. And of course, we all have prejudices to one extent or another, but to the extent that you can be open-minded and willing to be guided by the evidence being written, be it written or oral, and just try consciously to look at it as dispassionately as possible, I think is vitally important. And you know, you have to, of course, then look at the person who's telling the story, the eyewitness, what prejudices they may bring to their telling of a story, and whether or not they were even present at the events that they purport to describe. I found, interestingly, people have asked the question when you're writing about American Indians, be it my book on the Indian Wars or my current project, you know, how valuable is Indian oral testimony, Indian oral history? I found it is not of particularly great value, particularly Indian oral history today, because the Indians themselves had their own prejudices and they had their own partisans within their peoples, and their oral history has become, you know, become a slave to that. So that's been a particular challenge for me.
How concerned were you, as a critic might rather disobligingly put it, how concerned were you at the ethical presumption of yourself, a non-Indian, telling that story?
Not at all concerned. I did want to get at the truth of the story to the best of my ability. Again, particularly in my current book, I've been reading everything I can about the mythology, the religions, the daily life of the peoples about whom I'm writing, to try as much as possible to understand their perspective. Indians today are, I think, sufficiently removed from the events of their forefathers, just as we are from, you know, what our ancestors may have done in the Civil War, that I don't think there is necessarily an advantage or disadvantage to being an American Indian or not when writing this history.
I certainly felt quite a bit of circumspection when I, even though I was writing about a white U.S. Army officer in the West, both in dealing with African American history and in Native American history, you know, it's a very difficult thing writing, coming in as an outsider and writing history of others, and yet the United States has been so shaped by the collision of various groups and various peoples that it's impossible to write a history of the United States as a republic without going beyond yourself, no matter who you are, and to try to understand. And I think this speaks to the kind of, again, the literary and scholarly overlap of writing history, which is that, you know, as historians, like many writers in many categories, we undertake our projects often because we see something wrong in the world, and we want to understand it, or we want to understand how what's right got that way. And now those are questions. That's an impulse. Those are motivations we have as writers. But answering the question is a different process. So, you know, I'm interested in the idea of equality. I'm interested in justice and a universal sense of humanity that many of us think is the very best in the American tradition, and that we often fault the United States for not living up to. But it exists as everyone is equal, no matter who you are. We are all of equal value. We all have an equal say in society. That is a great American ideal. And then the fight is about how we fall down on it. Well, how did we get to that idea? That's interesting to me. That's important to me. And how do we get to our ideas about the economy? And then, in the process of answering those questions, if I don't find that I've got to rethink some of my assumptions and change my mind, I'm doing it wrong. So an example is, and this speaks to, you know, assessing the evidence and also assessing the way others have assessed it. So for example, my second book was about Cornelius Vanderbilt. Well, I entered that project knowing him from his years as a railroad tycoon. He was, you know, famously, he was the one for whom the robber baron metaphor was actually invented by Henry Raymond, the editor of the New York Times, and I think it was 1859. So, you know, I had this idea of him. Well, it turns out his career started before the War of 1812. And my editor sent back the early chapters and said, I don't know what's wrong. I'm not a historian. You've got to rethink this. And I went back and I had to read Joyce Appleby, and she became a great friend, and read other historians of the early republic, and to engage with the writings of Bernard Bailyn, and to really dig into how society was changing. And I found, to my surprise, that Vanderbilt, who becomes this embodiment of corporate power in our society, around whom arguments about regulation and the power of the corporation form, was someone who was seen as a radical figure in the early republic, and that he used Jacksonian language, that a kind of populist laissez-faire idea was seen as a radical view, and that the Whigs and the Federalists had an idea of partnering government and the wealthy interests to develop the economy, and competition and entrepreneurship was actually kind of seen in some ways as a radical view. I had to totally rethink my whole approach to the subject. And I had to completely rewrite the early chapters. And then it began to make sense out of the rest of his life. And I also developed respect for this person who was so problematic for society. And so I ended up finding one of the best quotes about him was from Charles Francis Adams Jr. It was Henry Adams' brother, and for much of his life, much more famous than Henry. And he wrote a famous article about one of the great Gilded Age episodes, which is problematic historically, but a great piece of writing, the chapter of Erie. And he said, Vanderbilt, I'm going to bobble a little bit. He said he instinctively inspires admiration in the man and alarm for the public. And I thought that was a nice way of putting it. So, you know, that was a case where, by sort of challenging, I go in with this idea, like, how did we get to our idea about regulation and opportunity in the corporation? And then to face the evidence and to see the way history changed over time
and how words that have one meaning now had a different meaning at an earlier period, that I got a much richer and more interesting picture. And then you have the last piece of it is understanding human beings. And that, you know, if you're writing as a historian, you often want to get to the essence of things, understand it. And there is an inherent flattening aspect of that. And now, I would not include any of the historians of this panel in this, but, you know, there's often an impulse to kind of turn your subjects, your historical characters, into what Ian Forster called flat characters. You can describe them, they're always going to be that way, they're never going to surprise you. Whereas human beings are inherently round characters. They're capable of surprising you convincingly. Now, to evoke that humanity, that complexity and contradictory nature on the page is hard because you're limited to the evidence. And yet we know it's there, and trying to find that is difficult. And with Vanderbilt, my problem was is that he was such a relentless guy and so successful that I had to really struggle to find the complexity. With Custer, it was easy.
If I could just push back a little on the presumption of your question, Steve. I think that our obligation as historians is not so much to be right as it is to be honest.
Yeah.
And I think that, and maybe this reflects my career as an attorney, but I feel like what I'm doing is I'm taking the evidence that I have and I'm building an argument around that evidence, which I hope will just be part of a larger conversation with other historians that they may disagree with me and they may be more right than I am, but my contribution is trying to provoke a discussion.
Well, I disagree. No.
At last.
So I'm the man. I'm the most fully institutionalized and domesticated academic historian on the table. And I spend a lot more of my time teaching than I have writing, and then being a dean and a president. And I just stepped down as president of the Organization of American Historians, and there I gave just a blistering presidential address when I said we've got to be a lot more popular and open to every new form. And so, keeping with my general spirit of antagonizing the people I'm speaking to, now I want to defend academic history and all its manifestations because, you know, your question, Steve, is how do we deal honestly with the evidence, which is basically all the historians do. What I told them is that, what is history? It's a reckoning with every piece of information created before today. Right? There's nothing that we can't do. There's no form that's not history. It's documentary, it's podcasts, it's blogging, it's theater. All those things can be history as long as you're true to the record that we have. Now, but part of that is, and it brings back a terrible memory that I have. You'd mentioned that I was a finalist for the National Book Award. The night that I lost that, David McCullough and I were on the Charlie Rose show together. He'd also lost that night. And he was like the third time that he'd been on Charlie Rose, and I had not been, and I was kind of amazed by it. So they're on first name basis, and he said, "Hey, David, how's your book doing?" He says, "It's great. This is the Truman biography." He said, "I'm up to about 660,000 copies now." I said, "That's great." And so, and then he says, "Professor Ayers," which I was already in the hole, right? So, Professor Ayers, you know, how would you compare your book to David's? And I said, "Well, except for about 600,000 copies, they're almost exactly the same." But what I said was, is that you wouldn't know from reading, and this is not true for any other authors here, but it is true for a lot of popular history, you wouldn't know that anybody else had ever written a word about Harry Truman. And I just said that. I think it's important. How do we know if we're grappling with the evidence in the right way? Peter says in a defensible position, you look at it kind of with fresh eyes. I kind of look at it, I want to know everything else everybody's ever said, and then see where do I differ, right? What's the original thing to say there? But McCullough, this great response, he says, "I don't write for other historians." And it's like, that wasn't my point, but missed that moment, so I like to relive it in public as often as I can. But the point being, it's not a matter of writing for other historians to build upon the work of people who came before. And, you know, you're talking about the impossibility, really, of mastering the literature of the American Civil War, especially if you do every aspect of it. It's true, but I believe that history believes that we're getting better. I believe that we think that we learn from each of the books that came before us, whether they're right or wrong, we disagree or agree. And so the trick is how to know that, but not drag readers back through that. Well, you've never read this book. I want you to know that I disagree with it, kind of. I think is a great way to bring readers into the story. So that's a problem if you're trying to write for a larger audience and be true to the cumulative knowledge that we built over those 50,000 books. It's a tricky thing, and that's why God made footnotes.
And a caveat to what Ed said is you certainly want to have a deep understanding of what's coming before and build upon previous literature in most cases. But I don't want to disparage very my heart and wounded knee unduly, but that's something did not want to build upon, because there is a case of an elegantly written book, a powerfully influential book, but one of the worst pieces of history I've ever read, not to put too fine a point on it. Because it was written, actually initially written as a children's book. And the editor convinced D. Brown to make it the book for the general market, because it was a hot topic. I mean, this was the Vietnam era, the nation was, again, discovering the wrongs done the Indians. You had films like Little Big Man coming out. You had the sense of guilt, and he played on that perfectly. But in doing so, he ignored a vast number of sources. He misused sources he had. So there's something that, a case where you don't necessarily want to build. You want to understand yes. the works, but not necessarily build on them. But even when you're building on previous works, one error that you need to avoid is to assume that even the best of works, that the historian or the author got it right in his or her reading of the primary sources. So you're really always drawn back, or should be drawn back, to the primary sources, which Ed did so well in his book, as by way of example. So you want to build on other works, but you don't want to take them for granted. Because if you go back to the primary sources, you will find different interpretations. You maybe even find actual errors in the use of them. So it's kind of a mixed bag.
Yeah. Well, yeah. The historiography, the way that historians think, and new questions, kind of what is being emphasized. If you are you're rising in the academic profession within the academy, then you're expected to write for other historians in the sense of narrow monographs that engage in these closed professional discussions. And that's a good thing. I mean, I'm not against that at all. I write history that makes use of all those books, and I'm glad the profession forces all these poor young historians to write difficult books about narrow topics.
You're welcome.
Yeah, I mean, it's an important thing. And what I do is I write, as actually all of us have done, narrative books that incorporate things into a synthetic narrative, even though they make arguments. But that historiography changes the way we see things. So for example, in writing about Custer, I was really interested in his ideas about race. And he talked about it all the time. And he talked about racial equality and slavery. And he was adamantly opposed to Lincoln's election.
And he was a smart man.
And he was smart. He was much smarter than people realize. And he was engaged with the intellectual discussion of the time. But his interests didn't interest people in the past who'd written about him, because that was a part of the nature of the historical discussion and the nature of the public discussion. And that has changed. It's not that I was some genius who suddenly said, we should pay attention to this. I mean, I am engaged in that discussion too, and it drew my attention to these things. When I wrote about Jesse James, he'd always been seen as kind of a marginal folkloric figure who was kind of America's Robin Hood. Well, he wrote, when he first compared himself to Robin Hood, it was in the context of a letter to the press. It was in the context of contrasting himself with Ulysses S. Grant, who was up for re-election. And he said, please don't group me with Ulysses S. Grant. They rob everybody and keep it. At least we rob the rich and give to the poor. So I will close by urging my readers to vote for Horace Greeley and against Grant, and then taxes will be lower and I won't have to rob. But the point was that when you actually paid attention and took seriously the evidence in the context of what historians have revealed and what we now know about Reconstruction in that period, suddenly what the person actually said takes on new meaning. And so, this is why I'm actually just going to push back against this word popular history, because, and actually Ed is one of the great, as he mentioned in his, about his presidential outgoing address for the OAH, he's one who's really emphasized the vast spectrum of history and how it all should be taken seriously. I push back a little bit on the use of the word popular history just because there's a hint of it not being serious. And of course, there is not serious popular history. But my goal isn't to popularize. It is to approach serious scholarship with new questions, but also with a literary sensibility, which I think is demonstrated to this panel really well.
Now, speaking of a literary sensibility, let's raise another kind of question. When I lived in New York at 92nd and Broadway, I had a fairly substantial railroad apartment and many thousands of books. On one wall was fiction, from Arabian Nights to Stefan Zweig. On the other wall, arrayed basically as the march of time, was from, you know, Neanderthals to NATO, history. And people would come in from time to time, we'd have a dinner or whatever, and they would look at these two walls, and sometimes they would say, well, how do you organize your books exactly? And I would say rather flippantly, well, on that wall, pointing to the wall of fiction, I would say, well, that's all the lies. And then I'd point to the wall of history and say, well, there's the truth. But of course, as I grew older, I realized it's just exactly the opposite. There was more truth in a short story by Chekhov than in the whole of Gibbon. So my question to you is, to what extent, if any, either for reasons of style or being inspired by the truthiness of that perception so well articulated by one of Renoir's characters at the end of the movie, The Rules of the Game, the trouble in the world is that everyone has his reasons. To what extent have you, in any regard, been influenced by your reading of novels or fiction?
I would say I've been influenced about, in terms of the way I present my story, the way I the way I write, the way I approach it, I'd say about 90% by fiction, and not the fiction that one might assume. I mean, I'm maybe the oddball here. I'm not a professional historian. I was my academic background was in international relations, Chinese, and then graduate, public administration. I was a career foreign service officer in the senior foreign service. I mean, I lived a lot of history from working with the Contras in Nicaragua to surviving terrorist attacks in Peru and on down the line. But I'm not a member of the Academy. Well, I guess I'm in that way alone, I'm bringing a unique background to my writing. But I find when I'm actually engaged in writing, as I am now, my reading is as far removed from the subject matter as possible. I read a lot of crime noir, a lot of the pulp fiction of the 1930s and 40s, a lot of the science fiction of that period, a lot of classic macabre stories, and I find it enlivens my narrative. It reminds me to try to tell to keep things moving, keep the pacing lively. So once I've researched a book and read the materials germane to that, I think then I turn to fiction to really help me with my voice.
Another place that I've been sort of inconvenient. Yeah. I'm just looking at people picking up the microphone is the indication I have as you're getting ready to speak. So,
I wasn't picking up the microphone, but now that I have, I will.
So, I have mine.
So. I was going to say that I don't think I'm not a great fiction reader. I will confess, I read a lot of other stuff between economics and history and science. And several critics commented that my writing was very cinematic, and I think that I'm probably more influenced by popular cinema in terms of my writing style and the way I try to build tension in stories to try to propel readers forward. I also think probably the other influence in my writing is from teaching, and I teach international business and economic classes and constitutional law, and those are subjects which often lull people to sleep. And I learned that the only way to kind of maintain interest in the class was through storytelling. And so I really developed a technique of telling stories and getting people to see the sort of literary content of legal cases and think about them in terms of little short stories. And so I think that's really helped my writing.
In one sense, like I basically write what I want to read. I write a book for myself, and I hope it appeals to others. But I write it in a way that appeals to me, in the style that appeals to me. You know, this.
I'm weird in this regard too. Is that I think our discipline, our practice, is basically 19th century voice. What we think of, we miss modernism somewhere along the way. And so my book is actually influenced more by modern literature and even postmodern literature than it is by the standard narrative genres. And so this book I published back in 92, one really long review essay said that I questioned truth, and you know, it was like I was a postmodernist. And if you go back and say, well, what is the history? It's telling a story that accords as closely as possible to the documentary record, then we could write it any way we choose. But we don't choose to write in a very broad array of styles. It's basically a genre. You know, and the way people pick up a romance novel, they expect it to be a certain way. And generally when people pick up a history book, they expect it to be a certain way. And I've just kind of chafe at that and say, why? Why can't we just kind of, you know, take advantage of all the exciting work all the way back, you know, to Faulkner and Virginia Woolf and all those kinds of, John Dos Passos? That's what is inspiring to me, is people who would sort of take the story apart and put it back in a new way.
Well, that's interesting you say that. If I may indulge everybody with a little story. When I was at Yale University Press, I reached out to Greil Marcus, who many of you may know for his excellent book, Mystery Train, Images of America and Rock and Roll and Other Things. And when I got to Yale about 7 or 8 years ago, I rang him up. We were old friends. And I said, Greil, isn't it about time that you wrote your definitive history of rock and roll? And he immediately said, that is one of the stupidest ideas I've ever heard. And I said, why is that? He said, because it's been done. It's been done this way, that way, and everybody knows the story. I mean, there's Chuck Berry, and then there's the Beatles, and then there's this and that, and everybody knows the story. So I said, well, thanks very much, and we hung up. And the next morning, I come into my office, the phone is ringing off the hook, and it's Greil here in Berkeley saying, you know, I've been thinking more about your really stupid idea. And what if we were to do it a different way? What if we were to take 10 songs and we were to tell the whole story through just 10 songs? And they don't have to be the songs that were the most popular. They could be the B-side that nobody ever heard. But if we regarded each of those songs as a kind of bit of the crucial DNA out of which, if you were to put it in a petri dish, you could grow some essential aspect of the whole genre, wouldn't that be much more fun and give people a way of entering the story that would be exciting? So we did. And it turned out to be one of his best-selling, most critically acclaimed books in many years.
He named The Flaming Groovy Shake Some Action as one of those 10, which I think is one of the most brilliant insights into American popular music. So the California group Flaming Groovies, check them out.
I hate to step on that. This is actually a question that is hugely important to me, and I think a lot about. And when I teach seminars on writing, I refer to history and writing, fiction, and writing about fiction, like E.M. Forster, David Lodge, who is a novelist and literary critic, who's written a lot about techniques. And when I write, one of the formative experiences for me as a writer was a fellowship I had at the New York Public Library at the Coleman Center, which brings together both academic, non-academic people like myself, playwrights, poets, novelists, and I workshopped a chapter of my Vanderbilt biography. And so there's a moment when Vanderbilt had been in one of the early train wrecks in America, and he was lying in the ditch, you know, with his back broken, spitting up blood. And I mentioned, simply because it was interesting and in the record, that this meteor had flamed overhead and everybody was talking about it. And so Nathan Englander, who was a novelist who was one of the people in my class of fellows, said, you realize by including that you're connecting Vanderbilt to the universe. Is that what you want to do? And I hadn't thought about the literary implications of the details that I included. I was thinking, this is there and it's interesting. And I was thinking about the historical record only. And I thought, no, I don't want to do that. The reason he survived, he was the most unspiritual person you could ever meet, but he was the grittiest, toughest son of a bitch you'd ever could have met. And his sheer earthy determination is what got him through that. But when I got to writing Custer, in his first year in the West in 1867, his marriage was falling apart. He'd gotten himself in trouble. He was out on this first expedition against the, what turned into a war, against the Southern Cheyennes and Oglalas and other Kiowas and others. And he was desperate to get back to his wife, and he kept writing letters back to her saying, there's not going to be a war. I'll be back soon. Everything will be great. And then he wrote about how he'd seen some amazing sights, you know, an owl coming out of a prairie dog village, the skeleton of a buffalo, and then amazing Western phenomenon, the mirage. I'm going to leave that in, because everything has been writing as mirage, but I'm not going to say that. I'm just going to leave that there. It evokes what I want to evoke. And when I got to the story about his courting of his wife, Libby, I used a literary technique of, in one chapter, presenting this troubled courtship from his perspective, and then retelling the story in the next chapter from her perspective, when the same events look very different. And you know, these are not, I did not invent these. I'm not the first person to use these in history. But, you know, I think that we enrich the experience of the reader, and we make the book more more valuable. It becomes a part of literature and not just the historical record when we use these things. So, for example, like I try to play on the reader's knowledge, but not in ways that it, prior knowledge is dependent. You know, with Custer, everybody knows he's going to die. Everybody knows what's going to happen. And so I just drop in little Easter eggs, you know, about alluding to that fact indirectly so that you know what's going to happen. The first line of the book it's about his first court-martial when right after he graduated from West Point. And I said, Custer's guilt was never in doubt. The question was how harshly he should be punished for being Custer, which is, of course, the great question that hangs over the entire book. And so, you know, when I read historians and biographers who are thinking in a literary way about what they're doing, I'm just like, oh, I love this. And I have that impulse as a reader to want to write to the author and get to know them. And I try so hard to do that because it's such a wonderful experience. And I get frustrated with people who write in cliches and stock phrases, and there's some highly selling writers, biographers and historians who do that, and there's no reason to do that. We're all writers as well as scholars.
And you know, when just picking up what you said about Custer, yeah, we all know he's going to die, but that doesn't take away from the drama of your narrative. And that's one thing that, as I'm writing about Chief Tecumseh, I'm bearing in mind, previous biographers of him have portrayed him from the very start, from the prologue, as this great tragic figure of a cause that was doomed to failure, as if he was some great Greek tragic character. Well, that wasn't the case. You know, the cause actually wasn't doomed to failure if you look at what was occurring at the moment in which it was occurring. Nothing was preordained, and that's something that I think many biographers and historians, none here, make the mistake of doing, just assuming the outcome and steering the story from the beginning along those lines, when in fact, and you lose a lot of dramatic tension that way. Plus, it's not good history. I think finding that very much again the case with Tecumseh. I mean, everything was touch and go to the very last minute.
Oh, I want to agree with that, by the way. And I think that something that I call, you know, rather than suspension of disbelief, when you're writing a narrative, you want to create suspension of prior knowledge,
yeah,
so that the reader has the feeling like this actually could go differently. Right. Like, maybe things won't go the way that I know that they will go.
Don't get ahead of yourself.
Yeah, and then that again, like you said, as Ed said also, and actually as you're saying about accidents in history, you know, that is the wonderful thing where you really do immerse them in the moment, and they feel like, you know, maybe I'm wrong. You know, it's just this kind of subconscious thought which you want to evoke.
I want to leave some time for questions, and but I also want to say neither historians nor readers nor anyone in a current generation should ever regard a single work as a definitive history. Historians are in dialogue with other historians. That's the nature of the profession, and so is any serious reader in dialogue. So we live in a society, we live in a world in which various forces would have us believe that all answers are contained in a single book. We come, I think it's fair to say, all of us from the school of 2-3 many books. You can never read too many. You can never.
I disagree strongly. I think all answers are contained in a single tweet.
Give the tweet time, and ultimately it may be the art form that we now consider haiku. Let's open it up to some questions. We've got at least one person here. We've got a lot of questions, and at least two microphones, one up and one there. So let's go to this woman here and speak directly into the microphone. Don't be afraid of it.
Thank you. I was wondering if you could talk about the role of the editor and publisher in your process of developing your works and the writing.
I think, you know, there's in fact, we were talking about this, Steve and I, before the panel, that the role of editors is really not as fully appreciated as it should be, and there's some will say that, well, there's no editing that goes into books anymore, and quite the contrary. I owe a great debt, starting with my agent, who helped shape my proposal and kept sending it back to me and over until I got it, right, essentially. To copy editors, I had an incredible copy editor who saved me from probably one of the most egregious errors I could have made. A simple error, but so egregious that I would have been doomed in the eyes of Custer buffs and many reviewers. And that for some reason I had Custer being born in Michigan instead of Ohio. And once I said that, that became the historical truth in my mind. And she caught that, where many of my readers hadn't caught it. And she saved me from potentially crucifying reviews. If he can't even get Custer's birthplace right, how the hell can you believe anything he says on any level beyond that? So I think the role of an editor is, in a copy editor, it can be very profoundly important.
One of the primary benefits they had is patience. This stuff is really time consuming to produce. And to stay interested in you and to think that they would still like to talk with you, even though the manuscript really might be a couple of years away, seems to embody a kind of patience that people shouldn't generally be expected to have.
Going forward, we're going to introduce just a little clarifying note. One question, one answer. Another question, another answer, so that the time doesn't get hoovered up. Yes, sir.
One of you mentioned that God created footnotes. God also created the mosquito. The title of the session is Turning History into Page-Turning Prose. Footnotes are, I think, antithetical to page-turning prose. So can you speak about the need for footnotes? Are they more for the author than the reader? I've never found them useful in reading non-academic history.
Actually, may I? I'm the lone publisher here on the thing, and let me speak to that, because that's it's a serious question. Actually, I mean, by and large, trade publishers would rather not have footnotes, or as few as they can, because they regard the mere sight of them as making readers, potential readers, allergic to buying the book because it feels like homework. So you will have noticed that even in works by major historians published by distinguished presses, that the notes are generally banished to the back. No longer are they actual footnotes at the foot of the page. And even in many, if not most, university presses, similarly, endnotes are preferred to having notes on the bottom of the page. And the endnotes, by and large, are as brief as possible. The footnote used, which I rather miss, as a kind of sotto voce call out to the audience that interrupts the argument for a side tangent of special or even witty interest has really gone the way of the dodo. It's very rarely used. When it is used in the hands of a marvelous writer, it's fantastic in my opinion, but it's mostly eschewed by most publishers, not favored. And this may be one of the reasons why, for other reasons, David McCulloch, best-selling author, is not regarded by other historians as a historian himself of the first rank, despite his plunder of various materials, his depth of knowledge, his felicity of style. By and large, there are few to no notes in the book. Many readers find that very pleasurable.
I am so happy I'm here. Let me just tell you. I've just published a book called Longing to Be Free, The Bear, the Eagle, and the Crown. What happened is I have degrees in literature, comparative literature, world literature, languages, anthropology, and linguistics, and then a PhD in a different field. As an educator, where I worked with schools throughout the country, including Native American schools, where languages were being re-established. And I worked with the scholars that began all that. I decided in retirement that I really wanted to know what happened in early New England with the Native Americans. And I took 6 years or more in my research because I read journals of the key members. I read biographies. I kept going and broadening this research. My question is, how acceptable is historical fiction that is very well researched? Because my passion is to get this into schools and libraries. So I'm going to continue to try and do that. But is it acceptable? Am I on a fool's errand here to try and increase the readership, but also the education of U.S. history?
One could cite, with respect to the Civil War, the best-selling trilogy by his name has gone right out of my head. Doesn't matter. Not a historian. He's a fiction writer, and I forget his name. But let's address the role, if any, of historical fiction.
I find that I love historical fiction about everything except the subject I know something about. And I say that not in any sarcastic way. You know, the Hillary Mantel, things like this. Like, wow, I finally get why that's interesting to people. But it's hard for me to read something that I actually know intimately is my own honest answer.
That I think that's a great point. The most influential fiction for me in writing about Custer was actually Tolstoy's stories based on his experience as an army officer in the Tsar's army in Russia's version of the Indian Wars in the Caucasus. And there's actually a short story called The Raid, which describes a young man who is a young officer who's talented and brave and puts on a big show, and yet is inwardly, how did he put it, and how much he suffered in his own, merely to appear in his own eyes as he wished to be seen. And that, you know, that image of that officer in a fiction, in a very different context, that evoked Custer in a way that brought all the sources into focus. So sometimes fiction, yeah, outside of your field actually gives you insight.
The question from the balcony, as it were. No, we can hear you a bit, but if you speak into the microphone, it'll be recorded.
Oh, well, I don't care about that.
But we do.
Thank you so much. I have a question about how you would, how you could help us as readers of current history, or the books that come out now about what's happening in the present, right? And how you would encourage us to ask certain anticipatory historical questions about what's being written about our current moment.
Right.
Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Can I answer that?
Yeah. So I think that's a really important question. In some ways, the book my most recent book, Without Precedent, kind of addresses that issue, because it's about the contributions of John Marshall and what he did to establish the independence of the judiciary and the rule of law in our country, and what happened before he was Chief Justice and what happened after. And obviously many of us have the collective sense that we're living in a time without precedent in many respects, and that the rule of law in some sense is really being challenged now by a populist president who got elected by demonizing certain groups in our society. The history of my book addresses specifically the election of President Jefferson and President Jackson, both of whom were populist figures who also demonized certain groups in our society, whose election also was deeply polarizing for the society. And the response of the court, and particularly the response of Marshall in trying to defend the independence and the integrity of the judiciary against those kinds of threats. What was, I think, critical in that case was that Marshall participated, he was Chief Justice for 34 years, longer than any other member of the court. One of the things I learned writing this book was you never want to write a biography about someone who lived that long. It just goes on and on. I think the person who said that only the good die young must have been a biographer. Marshall's time on the court, he participated in more than 1,100 decisions, more than half of which he wrote himself, and all but 35 of those opinions were unanimous. And that's extraordinary, given the record of the court today being so deeply divided and polarized. And even more remarkable was that all the justices who were appointed to the Supreme Court after John Marshall were all appointed by Republican presidents who opposed Marshall and who wanted to reverse his jurisprudence. And yet Marshall was able somehow to bring people together, to forge a consensus through compromise, and by choosing his battles carefully. I think that's the quality that's absent today in our court system, and also in our Congress and in our politics, and the need for people who are able to find that common ground and to forge consensus. And I hope that that's kind of the message of my book, and something that will give some people inspiration.
Do you have a chapter for each decision?
The woman here in the second row, that's you. Here comes a, wait for the microphone.
I've had the experience of writing something that became very popular, and now writing something that would be technically called more scholarly. And I think that I've learned something in the process, which is, as a biographer, I wrote Love, Anarchy, and Emma Goldman. So as a biographer, it was a story, and it was about love, and the footnotes were in the back, and, you know, and it had a lot of narrative. The narrative focus of writing was really important. Now that I'm doing the documentary history of Emma Goldman, I think that if you say that you want somebody to speak for themselves, there is an artful way to present that, to put it in an order, and to present, hate to say it, footnotes that are actually fascinating, because most people don't know that history. And so I would suggest breaking open the usual narrative to have different kinds of writings of history. And, you know, to make up for not having a narrative, to have an introduction that introduces you to the narrative. But the core of it being the person themselves. And I guess I'm lucky, because Emma Goldman was deported because she was so eloquent. So her words, even the words of spies, were interesting.
Well, that raises an interesting point, which is one that, as Ed has talked about and continues to speak about, there are many forms of history, and I the ways of doing it, and we have to be open to all of those. Another is that the nature of the sources often determines the kind of book you can write. So, you know, my first book was about a man who was a fugitive from the age of 16. You know, he didn't exactly keep a logbook. You know, I'm thinking of robbing this bank, and, you know, Cole Younger sure is getting on my nerves. It had to be contextual. It had to be as much history as biography by necessity. And you turn that necessity into a virtue. And then by the time I got to Custer, then there's all kinds of letters. His wife wrote 3 volumes. And then the virtue of that is that women, for example, who often there's an archival bias against, the women are full and rich, and I can do something different that I couldn't do in my earlier book. So, I think everybody's had that experience. The nature of the sources allows you to take different forms. And so.
I couldn't agree more. That problem that I'm facing with Chief Tecumseh and his brother, and I guess people who write about great American Indians inevitably face, is that they did not exactly leave journals either of their lives, and much of what is known about them, particularly their youth, is either lost or is as presented by white men, often by their enemies. And so it becomes very much contextual, whereas the early story of Chief Tecumseh is as much the story of the Shawnee Indians and other woodland Indians of their period as it is about him himself. And a lot of the conclusions I am forced to draw are they're somewhat tentative. And without writing a book in which it becomes one giant series of endnotes itself of perhaps is improbablys, I have to take a leap and make my best guess as to what likely occurred. And I found just the other night when I was contemplating the question, well, did Tecumseh speak English or not? And historians have come down on either side of the question. And I just put all the sources aside that were conflicting sources, and I sat back and said, okay, let's try to look at this logically. His closest companion from age 12 to age 28 was a captive Kentucky boy. They were inseparable, and that boy ended up speaking fluent Shawnee. Another one of his closest companions was another white boy captured the same age who also became fluent Shawnee. Well, they had to learn Shawnee from someone. They probably learned it from Tecumseh and other planmates, and Tecumseh probably learned some English in exchange. So I'm just applying, seems to me to be common sense, and I'm going to put it forward in the narrative, at least, as Tecumseh spoke English. And then in an endnote, I will explain how I came to that conclusion. The sources contribute to contextualize the nature of the narrative.
One more question.
Yes.
So when you're trying to write engaging but accurate history, how far do you feel you can go in terms of writing narrative that says someone who was dead 150, 200 years ago thought or felt a particular thing in response to events happening at the time?
I would never try to put words in their minds.
Feeling
was a different thing 150 years ago than it is. It's not like a universal that we could all know. We can sense how that is. But the good thing is that, you know, it's not always getting ready to rob a bank and, you know, writing, here's my plan. But the record of the past is so rich in glimpses. It comes often not in an essay, but just in a line, a phrase, and you go, okay, I recognize that. So I generally don't think you should get too far away from what we actually know people said and thought.
Well, this is something, again, that Ian Forster said. He said history, by which you can mean all nonfiction, since it's limited to the surface, we wouldn't know that Queen Victoria was not amused unless she said so. So he said, in that sense, fiction is truer than history because it goes beneath the surface. And we all know from our own lives that there's much more beneath the surface. Well, as a biographer, I can't take you beneath the surface, though it is my job to reflect on and point to the shapes and movement that I see beneath the surface and the potential meaning. And so, you know, you recognize patterns, you begin to see the way people consistently react. Custer was brittle and got outrageously defensive against even small bits of criticism. And that's a pattern. And so you can begin to describe, this is a man who was confident in one context and brittle, could be incredibly brittle. And you know, I begin to characterize the pattern I see. But I can't say, he thought this and he did that. You know, he was thinking this, unless it's something that he actually said or that he clearly acted out in that way. You know, I mean, there's got to be evidence on the surface. And yet we always think about what's going on the surface. Who are these are human beings, and they've got complex emotions, and we're always aware of that. And so, you know, there's always that tension.
I want to thank our panelists, Ed Ayers, Peter Cousins, Joel Paul, and TJ Styles, and your attentions. They will be available to sign their books outside the theater. Please give them a warm hand. Thanks so much.
We hope you enjoyed this podcast from the 2018 Bay Area Book Festival. For more podcasts, please go to www.baybookfest.org.